The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting just to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient, and then it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we'll hear a heart-to-heart talk, mother to daughter, about working for Playboy magazine, all back in its heyday under the late Hugh Hefner.
You know, and Hef had his finger on the pulse. The world was ready for a change. Otherwise, it wouldn't have followed him off a cliff. Right?
That's all coming up later. But we begin the hour with football. And this season, the player on everybody's mind hasn't set foot on the field even once. Colin Kaepernick, formerly of the 49ers, is an unsigned free agent. But the silent protest against police brutality that he began last year, taking a knee during the national anthem, now has a life of its own. We can thank the President of the United States, of course, for reigniting a protest that was not very popular in the first place and had kind of lost its momentum after Kaepernick left the 49ers.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb recently sat down with Bill Roden, late of the New York Times, now a contributor to ESPN's website, The Undefeated. Roden is also the author of the book, $40 Million Slaves, about black athletes in professional sports.
The first time we met was at a restaurant in Harlem, and you had a group of people there. Roman Oben from the Giants was there. Yeah, right. Yeah.
This is the little restaurant on.
It was on Eighth Avenue.
Yeah. Oh wow, man.
So we had this interesting conversation then, though, about the ways in which the American anxieties, if we could call it that, around race are so consistently refracted through sports. Mm. And I wondered if we could just start by talking about why do we always seem to find sports being the arena in which American attitudes, especially around race, become front and center.
Yeah, and I've thought about that, obviously, for decades. Mm-hmm. And two things. I've kind of changed my nomenclature. Because mm-hmm. our problem, we talk about race, and our problem in the United States is not race. Mm-hmm. It's racism. That's the problem.
Right.
And it's no longer a intersection. Mm-hmm. Of, so that intersection is now a collision. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and I was, you know, so the president is in Huntsville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Huntsville, Alabama at football season.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday afternoon, half of them are going to be at Auburn,
mm-hmm.
you know, front mm-hmm. and center. The other half is going to be at Tuscaloosa and mm-hmm. Alabama mm-hmm. cheering.
Mm-hmm.
Two teams, by the way, that when you look at the primary players, the starting teams, you could be looking at Howard and Alcorn.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
two historically black colleges. Yeah.
All these young black men mm-hmm. who are the object of mass incarceration, police violence. This is a demographic.
Mm-hmm.
Black folks are in your face, front and center. For a lot of people, this is the only time they really get to see a lot of young, virile black people in positions of, A, is positive and controlled. Mm-hmm. What's happening now is that this young generation, now these guys are saying, wait a minute, you know, you got to make a choice because mm-hmm. I now am a feeling wealthy black man, and I'm just not going to go out and play ball.
But there's a question, though, I think that I guess warrants some discussion, which is that we've had a great deal of conversation about kneeling during the national anthem. We've had a lot less conversation about the issue that Colin Kaepernick, that led Colin Kaepernick to kneel in the first place. As you watched this unfold, did it seem like something got lost in translation? Because we were not really talking about police violence. We were talking about the national anthem.
Not only law hijacked. Mm-hmm. It was hijacked. Mm-hmm. You know, they hijacked the message. And to me, the height of when I knew that the thing had totally been hijacked was, I guess, when the Dallas Cowboys and Jerry Jones and all the, you know, Jerry Jones had all his players, and they knelt before the national anthem. Then I said, well, that defeats the whole purpose.
Right.
Imagine if Tommy Smith and John Carlos would have, you know, raised their fist in the tunnel, or Dr. King would have given his, you know, "I Have a Dream" speech
in
like
in the hotel
in a, before in a barbecue somewhere. Right. The whole point of doing these things is to make people uncomfortable.
But it also has a kind of echo of history because this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Cleveland Summit. Mm-hmm. And I know you've written about this. And I wonder if you could just talk about what exactly the Cleveland Summit was and why it was significant.
So the Cleveland Summit came about, I think it was 1967. You said 50, right? I was mm-hmm. English major, so it was 67. So
you should have a segment, English majors do math.
Do
minor math problems.
You know, math, English, you know. But, you know, so... Jim Brown called the meeting. This was in 1967. And Jim Brown, who had just retired from the NFL, kind of stunning everybody because he was like, at that point, maybe the greatest running back ever. And he just walked away from the game, you know. But there were all these things that were going on in 67. Ali, major mm-hmm. among them was Muhammad Ali, said that he wasn't going to the draft. And so Jim Brown called a meeting of some of the top athletes, black athletes in the country. Lou Alcindor, who had later changed his name. I think he was maybe a sophomore in college, mm-hmm. junior.
He later became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he called all the athletes to Cleveland, where his office was based. And basically, these athletes met with Muhammad Ali the night before. Because a lot of these guys, including Jim Brown, had been in the Army or in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And finally, after a very, you know, sort of a very pointed conversation, they realized that this guy was standing on principle. They came the next day and they held a press conference, which is now, it's a famous picture of all the athletes. And they held a press conference saying that we support Muhammad Ali. Now, a lot of people point out that this was 67. A lot of those guys didn't have agents. Mm-hmm. No, they didn't have agents mm-hmm. back then.
Endorsements weren't as big a part of the picture then?
No part.
Yeah.
There's no part. And so that, to me, became my standard of what a black man was, a woman, or what a black athlete could do in this limelight, how you could use your podium, your stand, your arena, the way Ali did, the way Kurt Flood did, the way Smith and Carlos did, the way Jim Brown did. And I think that we went through this point of wilderness as the money started becoming so great that I think a couple generations back, and they culminated probably with Michael Jordan when
in the 80s
this
famous
is
Republicans buy shoes to comment.
Yeah, whether he's made it or not. I mean, there's but
some debate about whether he said this, but yeah.
But it's close enough.
Right.
Your actions speak louder than
the basic ethic that money was more important than any kind of political or social stand.
Right. And that set the tone, I think, for a couple of generations of black guys. Well, hey, man, if we just don't rock the boat, we can make it. But then you see, you know, and I think that's where we are now. So, you know, that's not a way to live. I mean, you know, and just because you don't rock the boat doesn't mean they're not going to deal with you. What did Dick Gregory say? Just because you think somebody's after you doesn't mean you're not.
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that nobody's after you, right? So you've heard, as have I, the commentary from a number of different quarters that, well, athletes should just keep politics out of sports. And, you know, many conservatives have said this in particular. I don't know, what's your estimation of that, the likelihood of it? Is sports ever apolitical?
You know, Jelani, listen, man, as soon as you play the national anthem, you politicize the sport. As soon as you do that, I mean, I'm a jazz guy. You go to concert, there's no national anthem, mm-hmm. you know, for a jazz league. There's no, go mm-hmm. in, hit them, you sit down. As soon as you play the national anthem, you politicize it. That horse has left the barn a long time ago. I mean, going back to Jack Johnson, it's always been politicized. What people are saying also, it depends on what your politics are. If the politics suit you, then it's okay. You know, it's okay. But so I think that conversation really is not, that's not to me a debatable issue. It's already, and also I think what it is that it's disturbing. What they're trying to say is that, you know, we don't want our hypocrisy to wash up on us.
Mm-hmm. What happens to Kaepernick? We've seen this before. This is even kind of maybe akin to that period where Ali was kind of in the wilderness in his career for refusing to go to Vietnam. How does this end for him?
I would love for it to end with him being on a roster or at least getting an opportunity to play. But then you think about it, Jelani. What happened right now, you know, Colin has become this symbol. If his career, if he doesn't play another down, his name will probably go down, I don't know, for the next, you know, 20, 30, 40 years as somebody who's triggered this thing. Now, if he gets on a roster suddenly, he throws 5 interceptions. Yeah, oh my God.
That becomes the story.
That's why you're talking, you know. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of lose this veneer of kind of sainthood or martyrdom when you get on there and you throw 5 interceptions and the team gets beat 55-0,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to just staying on, you know, in becoming this figure.
Is it better for him to not come back?
I mean, cynically, what I just painted was a cynical thing. But the backup quarterback is always the most popular person on the team
mm-hmm.
till you kind of give in and get signed. But I think as a show of good faith, for example, the owners are asking the players secretly now, what can we do? So, okay, first thing, sign Kaepernick. One of you SOBs,
mm-hmm.
sign Kaepernick. Guarantee you, we'll all say, okay. Now, the issues that he raised will still be with us, but you as owners have made a statement, said, mm-hmm. you know what? Maybe we did blackball this guy and wasn't right, and we're going to bring him back and give him a shot.
So should we do away with playing the anthem altogether?
I think so. And I've thought so for a while. And by the way, anybody who's been to a football, basketball, baseball game, go to the corridors while during the national anthem. People are buying popcorn and beer. They're standing like, they're not standing for the national anthem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing everything.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do at home when you're watching the game? And people aren't, you know, so again, this is this sort of hypocrisy that we've built a whole 5-week news cycle on.
Mm-hmm.
About the flag and the national anthem. Give me a break with this stuff. You know, but it's probably not going to happen. But yeah, I think that they should just stop it. Just come in and play Grand Funk or something. Just, you know, play So What. You know, maybe make that.
So I do not think that people are going to replace the national anthem with Funkadelic.
It would probably be
the most interesting development. One Nation Under a
Groove. Right?
That might actually be unifying. That could be a unifying.
This is a new national anthem. You heard it here first.
Here's a chance to dance our way out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down.
Bill Roden, a former New York Times columnist and a contributor to the ESPN website called The Undefeated. He spoke with staff writer Jelani Cobb. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Ready or not, here we come. Getting down on the one which we believe in. Can I get it on my good foot? Good God. By the time I get down, we're on the end. We're on the move.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. The death last month of Hugh Hefner reopened a debate about the Playboy founder and the world he created. When pornography was still a kind of secretive enterprise, Hefner put naked and near-naked women in full color right into the respectable households of America. Hefner thought he was an instigator of the sexual revolution, and he was making a great blow against Puritanism.
It's an attempt to replace the old legalism. It's certainly not a rejection of monogamy as such, but very much an attempt, in the case of premarital sex, there really hasn't been any moral code in the past except simply a thou shalt not. And,
well, that's a code, isn't it?
Well, perhaps. I don't think it's a very realistic one.
Not everyone saw it in such high-minded terms. Some thought women were being exploited, and that divide is still present in how people think about Playboy's legacy. Janice Moses was just 19 when she took a job in the photography department at Playboy, and she rose through the ranks to become a photo editor. Janice left Playboy before her daughter Michelle was born and didn't really talk with her much about the experience. Michelle followed her mother into the magazine business, although she works here at The New Yorker, where you don't get all that much nudity.
When you were 19 and you entered that environment for the first time, like, had you ever seen pictures of naked women before entering into that environment?
You know, it's interesting. That was one of Vince's questions during our interview. You know, have you ever been around nude models before? And quite honestly, I so badly needed a job that, of course, I had to tell a lie and say, yeah, oh, yeah, I've been around nude models before in art class. But truly, I hadn't. And, you know, at that time, Playboy was a much broader-based magazine. So it's not like there were naked ladies running around the studio all day.
And actually, I would love to hear a bit more about your personal interactions with Hefner. I know that when you became a photo editor, you were presenting your work to him on a very regular basis. What was he like to interact with?
He was intimidating. For sure. In fact, thankfully, I found these few pictures of what it was like to meet with him. And that's me sitting right now.
All right. So what's going on? There's a picture that I'm looking at. My mom is a blonde bombshell.
Look how we're looking at each other.
Mm-hmm. And he's holding his pipe in hand, wearing
always
a silk pajama shirt.
Always.
And they have the mock-up of the magazine in front of them, it looks like.
Yeah, that was, you know, what we called, I think we called it the Blue Book or the Black Book or something. It was a pasted-up book. That's how magazines were done in those days.
Oh, we have one?
The Brown Book. It was a pasted-up version of the book. And, you know, we went over it page by page, line by line, picture by picture. And when you think about how he was so involved in every detail, and for him, money was no object. It was all about perfection, whether it was re-editing the copy or reshooting the pictures, to the sometimes the great frustration of some of the people that worked for him, because he was very challenging and he had his view of perfection of everything.
Like, did you all feel like there was a mission that Playboy was on that you were a part of? Can you tell me, like, how that felt from the inside?
You take me back to a memory of a photo shoot that we did very early in my career. And we were on the campuses of, you know, the top five colleges, or what we thought were the top five colleges. And so we went to Antioch in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And we got there, and the kids were so upset. And a group of them literally stole the boxes of clothing that we had shipped from the fashion department to put on the models. And they said, we want to confront you, and we want to have a conversation with you. So they sat us down in a room in their student union. And these were the earliest days of demonstrations on campus. And so these kids, the boys, did a nude-in demonstration, and clusters of boys came through the windows running naked across this this panel. Of course, I was terrified for my life. I wanted to get out of there. And
did you understand their objections to Playboy? Did you understand what their grievances were?
Well, they thought we were the establishment.
But not to simplify it.
I don't want to simplify it, but for me, I must confess I could only scratch my head, because I was on the inside where I had so much freedom to do and be and work and express myself, that I was like, what's so conservative about us? What are they seeing? I'm just here.
Did you hear from the students? Did they describe to you, or did they give you a good sense of what they were objecting to?
As we walked out of that student union, this young college girl came up next to me. And we were very close in age at the time, actually. And, you know, there she was, braless, in her little kind of hippie top, and being oh so bold. And, you know, she was upset because she thought we were taking advantage of women. And yet she was standing there braless and free to be who she was, because we gave women the freedom to do that. So it was confusing for me.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story. She's like your foil. She's like the life you could have led in some ways.
Yeah.
Did you feel any envy
for her to be so bold? Of course I did. Here I am in my quilted top, because let's describe this picture. I'm in a quilted tapestry jacket. Mm-hmm. You know, God forbid anybody should see me braless.
Is that how you felt in the office? God forbid anyone should see me braless?
No, I have pictures here.
Well, you don't need to show them. But I mean, like, how did you feel about your own body in that setting, where women's bodies were the centerpiece?
Well, you know, let's go back to why women.
Did you get a lot of sexual attention?
Let's go back to why women burned their bras at that moment. Mm-hmm. It was Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan who came on the scene and made us powerful. And I was not attracted to what the girls in the secretarial pool wanted to do and wanted to talk about. I wanted to go out and be with the guys and test the film and search for the light and, you know, help set up the productions. And it was all there for me. They were like, sure, show up. Anything you want to do. Here, take this, do that. Be responsible for that. And, you know, by 21, I had a lot of responsibility. By 23, I was running the photo studio. By then, we had 6 staff photographers, 5 staff stylists, painters, carpenters, electricians, and I was running this whole little section of the business of the photo studio, the logistics, the production, the set building. You know, it was it fell on my desk at a very young age, because I felt this freedom to be able to do these things.
If you imagined your career, if you imagine it happening again, and you had that much responsibility and that much freedom at a place that wasn't Playboy, that didn't have the same social or political mission or influence, Do you think that would have changed the whole thing for you? Do you think that it could have been a religion somewhere else? Or was there something really Playboy-specific for you that made it what you believed in, that made it what you wanted to work for?
That's a difficult one to answer simply. You know, I landed this job as a kid and just stayed. And you know, I've told you there were times long before I left that I was very unhappy there, that I didn't like what the magazine was about. I didn't think some of it was funny. I didn't endorse it philosophically. I didn't want to see it on the pages. I didn't want to ask, you know, for people to do the things I was asking them to do.
What kinds of things made you uneasy?
I didn't like seeing two girls together in a sexual context.
Well, that's...
That's me. That's my opinion.
I also don't like that answer.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's just right, you know.
That sounds kind of homophobic, Mom.
Well, interesting. I didn't think of it as homophobic at that point. I thought of it as for the entertainment of the viewer.
The entertainment of the male viewer?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's what you were starting to notice.
That's what bothered me. That was when it all came together at the same moment, when it was Playboy and Penthouse and Hustler trying to compete for attention and sales. And so we wanted to push the envelope on, you know, how explicit or how suggestive. And it just went to a place that I wasn't comfortable with. And that's when I became unhappy with being there and doing this work. And so then I would just focus on what my job was. You know, when you're unhappy in a job, you don't leave the next day. You have to let it wear at you for a very long time until one day you go, I need out. I can't live my life. I remember the day that the guy in the next office got a raise, and he was a guy, and he got more than me, and we did the same job. I did more than he did, I thought. I'd produced 7 centerfolds that year, and he'd produced some pictorials. And I never thought that was fair. So for me, my rights as a woman were always very important. And it turned out to be the very best decision. I have you. I have my own wonderful business. And it's all good.
And, you know, I was remembering, you know, when I was 6 years old and Britney Spears came out with the album Hit Me Baby One More Time. I remember wanting it so badly, asking for it, and you got me the CD, but I know that you were sort of uncomfortable with the way she presented herself in this, like, skimpy schoolgirl outfit for an audience of young people. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where maybe that sense of discomfort came from for the kind of media that I was consuming and how it differed from what you thought about the work that you did then.
This has more to do with me as a woman than me as an employee of Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the me inspired by Gloria Steinem. And I felt, not Britney Spears particularly, but there was a moment in time around that time when there was a...
In my childhood.
In your childhood, when there was a bevy of female singers who came on the scene in very provocative clothing. There's another one who was competing.
Christina Aguilera.
Thank you. beyond provocative. Who I thought were taking us, we women, backwards. So the way we dressed the women in the magazine was not the way we walked around the office. Okay? There were no nude women walking around the office. In fact, there was actually nobody walking around in low-cut dresses with cleavage. Everybody was pretty buttoned up. In fact, if I pulled out enough pictures, you would see how really buttoned up everybody was. But I just felt that at the time of the Christina Britney era, there was a shift in female behavior in the everyday world and offices and just on the street that I didn't think was going to forward them getting more respect and equal pay for the work that they did or have a voice that was going to be rewarded or be heard or be respected.
So what was shown in the pages of the magazine entered into our everyday world and inspired the behavior of people outside of the realm of entertainment.
This is true.
It's been really special for me to hear these stories I've never heard before, so I'm really glad we did this.
Thank you so much.
Janice Moses, in conversation with her daughter, Michelle. Janice managed the photography studio at Playboy and was a photography editor. Michelle is on the editorial staff of The New Yorker. That's it for today's show. I'm David Remnick, and next week, we'll hear an interview with Chelsea Manning, the former intelligence analyst who served 7 years in prison after sending a huge haul of military and diplomatic cables to WikiLeaks. I hope you'll join us for that. Until then, have a great week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrato. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Sarah Sandbach, Jessica Henderson, and Terrence Bernardo. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.